Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you're out there across America listening to us, of course, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or if you're here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But right now, please hold your calls because we are going to have a fascinating program tonight. We have with us Mr. Robert B. Stinnett. We're going to be talking about his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And, of course, this has been something that people have talked about for the last 58 years. What did FDR know? What did President Roosevelt know about Pearl Harbor? Did he know there was going to be an attack? Or, of course, did this come as much of a surprise to him as it did to the commanders in Pearl Harbor, Admiral Kimmel and General Short? Well, of course, we know that they were tried for basically failure to be prepared. They were blamed for the tragedy, for the loss of some 2,800 American lives that were lost at the attack on Pearl Harbor. But really, were they responsible, or were they simply set up to take the fall so that there would be an enemy that people could rally against rather than realize that they had been betrayed, the men we had there had been betrayed, and it was done, as one of the people said, it was a small price to pay for getting America into the Second World War. Mr. Stinnett, thanks so very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell us, how long did you work on this book?
I started in 1982 and filed close to 18 years and filed FOIAs, that's Freedom of Information Act, under the federal law, and finally got what I wanted in January 1995.
All right, fine. And, of course, you found a lot of fascinating information and found you start out talking about a statement that had been put together by a naval officer laying out 8 steps that should be taken so America could get into the war. In other words, what we were going to do was put our naval fleet at risk so that it would be readily attacked by the Japanese. Would you like to get into that? Because this is long-range planning to precipitate the war so that we could drag America into that Second World War.
Yes, that is correct. On October 7th, 1940, a naval officer in naval intelligence proposed a plan to get Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor. He called for eight actions. You could also call them provocations to be aimed at Japan by the United States government so that Japan militarists would seize control of the Japanese government and really go all out for war against the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands.
And, of course, basically what we were going to do was keep putting pressure on the Japanese till they were literally forced to attack us. Wasn't that it?
Yes. There were these 8 provocations. One of them was to keep the Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. Another was to cut off all of their oil and access to natural resources. Another one was to send United States warships into Japanese territorial waters to antagonize the militarists in Japan. Others were to provide loans to China, which was then engaged in war with Japan, and also to send the United States submarines, a huge fleet of submarines, 24 of them, into the Far East.
But I think the most important thing was cutting off the Japanese supply of oil and insisting that the Dutch government stop letting Japan buy oil from the Dutch East Indies. And, of course, how does an industrialized society with no natural resources survive if you cut off their access to raw materials and to oil? I mean, what would happen if we had no oil here in the United States and say the Russians put an oil embargo so that we couldn't buy oil anywhere in the world, what would happen to the United States today? Would we have any alternative but to go to war? In fact, putting that embargo on the Japanese, in fact, was an act of war, wasn't it?
Yeah, so that was the whole idea. That was one of, that was the last provocation in this memorandum of October 7th, 1940. And President Roosevelt put that into effect, you know, in July, I believe it was July 28th, 1941. And that caused Japan to go all out for war preparation. They mobilized their young men, called them up for draft, and so forth.
But, of course, an embargo on a country is an act of war. We had actually declared war on Japan. It might not be a fighting war, but it was an economic war. But the American people didn't know that. And wasn't a lot of this the fact that Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to get us into the war in Europe? He wanted to get us into the war against Adolf Hitler?
Yes, that was the proposal of October 7th, 1940. This is the Navy commander who made this proposal, said that Adolf Hitler and the German armed forces were the real danger to the United States, for at that time they were poised to invade England, seize the British fleet, merge it with the German Navy, then come over to our hemisphere and perhaps invade Canada, Bermuda, and so forth, the British islands and property in the Caribbean and South America.
At least that was the justification that Commander McCulloch used. Now, how did you ever get this eight-point memorandum? Because this is the first time I've ever read it, and I've certainly studied Pearl Harbor. I've read Admiral Kimmel's book and the book, The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor, and Harry Elmer Barnes' book on perpetual war for perpetual peace. And where did you ever get this memorandum? Because this, of course, shows a planned program to provoke the Japanese to attack.
Well, that is right. And of course, this plan was locked in Navy vaults right after Pearl Harbor, you know, right after December 7th, and was never introduced to any of the congressional investigation or any investigation. So this includes the investigation, by the way, of in 1995, just 5 years ago. And
everything has been cover up for 50 years.
Yes.
And, of course, what the government does, if it conceals the evidence, then how can you have a fair and open hearing?
Well, you cannot, and nor can those in academia or journalists or authors, publishers. You don't have access. You can't write the truth.
And, of course, so eventually you got this through the Freedom of Information Act?
Yes. I had asked, I was interested in learning more about our interception of Japanese Navy communications prior to Pearl Harbor. These were the radio messages sent to the Japanese fleet. So I asked for those records. And lo and behold, while I was looking through these records when they were released to me in January 1995, this eight provocation memo came up. It was hidden among these intercepts. I call intercepts. These are where we're intercepting the Japanese fleet. And lo and behold, this was I really think it's the smoking gun of Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, really what was so interesting was that the lie has been told over and over again. Well, of course, the Japanese fleet was, using radio silence, so we didn't know where the fleet was. We lost all sight of the fleet. Why, it just suddenly appeared that Sunday morning there in Pearl Harbor, as the planes came in, we didn't know where it was, and that wasn't true at all. What you demonstrated so beautifully was that we tracked the Japanese fleet right to the northwest shore of Oahu. We knew it was there, but we did not want the commanders in Pearl Harbor to know, because we didn't want them to move the battleships to sea or do anything to defend themselves. In fact, in one of the books I read, we had something called the sabotage alert, where you gather all the airplanes and you put them to a little bunch there in the middle of the field, make an excellent bombing target. But the idea is why we can protect them from sabotage. But didn't we sort of give the Japanese the ideal target so that the last thing we wanted for them was not to attack?
Well, the orders came directly from President Roosevelt on November 27, 1941, about 10 days before the attack. He issued orders to the Pacific commanders, both in Hawaii and the Philippines. He said, the United States desires that you stand aside and don't go on the offensive and let Japan commit the first overt act of war. And that phrase, overt act of war, was right out of that October 7th, 1940 memo that I told you about.
But, of course, they'd been telling the commanders at Pearl Harbor that there was no suggestion there was going to be an attack there. When the attack came, it would be in the Philippines or in the Far East. Didn't they actually deceive Admiral Kimmel and General Short?
Yes, that was part of the deceit. But they would, I'm sure, if you were questioning them today, they would say, well, we wanted to unite the American people and do away with the isolation movement that was so prevalent in 1941.
And so you can justify killing those boys in the name of a greater good.
Well, haven't we heard that before, that the end justifies the means?
Yeah, we did it with the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, an incident that now we find out really didn't occur that way, but of course it was for the greater good. We got into Vietnam. But of course, when you have people that are telling lies in government, who can you trust? And the fascinating thing about your book, as I read it through, I find that time and time again, you will go to people or you'll go over records and they'll be just sort of deleted. At one point, certain parts of things you were trying to get or other people had tried to get had been checked out of a holding place and never returned. There were certain logs that you tried to get, radio logs that were really very important. Wasn't there a radio log from one of the Matson Line ships that sort of mysteriously disappeared just before a hearing, never to be seen again?
Yes, you see, all radio operators at the time in the Pacific, both commercial, like the Matson Lines or the Lurian that you're talking about, as well as military, kept radio logs on their messages and so forth. And the Lurline was one, and they heard the Japanese fleet, their radio operator, the Japanese fleet in the North Pacific, and had details on that. But that was seized by the Navy on December the 10th, after the Lurline returned from a voyage to Hawaii.
And they had to seize it because they couldn't allow the American people to know that that radio log showed that there was no radio silence, that the Japanese Navy was broadcasting, and they knew exactly where it was.
That is right. And when we're talking about the Japanese Navy, we're talking about the carrier force in the North Pacific as well as the submarine force in the Central Pacific. There was a two-pronged force coming at Hawaii.
And, of course, one of the most interesting things was what John Toland, who's an author and wrote the book Infamy, actually discovered. Would you like to talk about that? Because that is really such an important document, and, of course, this is never discussed. I mean, in other words, when we discuss Pearl Harbor, we ignore all the evidence, and we talk about non-important things like we do with most congressional or these independent evaluations that we have, these independent committees, special prosecutors, things like that. We never talk about the really important issues, but what did John Toland discover about the government's knowledge of the fleet, the Japanese fleet, off the northwest shore of Oahu?
Yes, so John Toland, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner, journalist and author, had started researching this in the 1970s. But he couldn't get the records that substantiated a lot of testimony that he received from the from U.S. naval intercept operators, and the Navy would not release that to him, so he was cut off. But he did get the Lurline log, and he did talk to a Robert Ogg, who was an intercept operator or a part of the Naval Intelligence in San Francisco, who confirmed they had located the Japanese fleet in the North Pacific.
But what about the, wasn't it the Danish ambassador that actually had put in his diary that he'd been to the war room and they'd actually showed him where the Japanese fleet was before Pearl Harbor? And didn't he actually send a directive on that was to Denmark that was actually forwarded there? So there was no question at all. It wasn't simply something in the diary, but it had actually been sent before Pearl Harbor, letting his government know that exactly where the Japanese fleet was?
Well, yes. You're speaking at it's Commander Ranoff, Captain Ranoff of the Netherlands Navy.
Netherlands, okay,
yes,
right.
And he was the Netherlands naval attaché in Washington, and he was also a communications intelligence expert and had been born in Indonesia. So in Indonesia, which we now call... which is we now call it, it was the Netherlands East Indies in 1941. But anyway, Ranoff was reporting from his government facilities there in Jakarta that they were intercepting the Japanese fleet also. And so they told that to John Tolan.
All right, so they knew exactly where it was. And, of course, our government knew where it was. And wasn't all this information being fed back to the White House?
Yes, absolutely, by a very secure method so that it would not leak out.
And yet, of course, when they knew the attack was coming, they already had the telegrams that had broken the code. Instead of actually sending this through naval information to warn Admiral Kimmel and General Short the attack was coming, they sent them a telegram by Western Union that arrived after the raid came. I mean, all they had to do was pick up a phone or pick up a radio and send it. And then they sent a telegram? Were they specifically trying not to warn them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't see how else you could come to that. You know, there's no other conclusion.
So, of course, then they had the audacity to try these men to destroy their professions, to destroy their careers for dereliction of duty when they weren't responsible. It was the people back in Washington, D.C. who were setting them up simply as fall guys for their responsibility for the murder of 2,800 American boys.
Well, yes, they were never tried, though. They were relieved of their command and then forced into retirement.
Well, weren't there some? There were several investigations of that, though, weren't there?
Yes, there were investigations by, I think, 9 investigations, as I recall. But there were never any formal court-martial charges filed against either Admiral Kimmel or General Short.
I think they wanted to be tried, though, didn't
they?
To exonerate themselves, and they wouldn't do it. Was that it?
That's right. They did want this, but then, of course, that would have forced the U.S. government to release all of this type of information that, that we're talking about here tonight.
Well, if they had Janet Reno, they wouldn't have to release anything. She would have just had it all shredded, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, you know, the great tragedy of this whole thing is that the Japanese government was literally had no alternative. They either had to commit hara-kiri, which they weren't about to do, or go to war. Now, didn't Ambassador Gru, who was in Japan at the time, have information that they were planning on attack on Pearl Harbor? And didn't he send that information back to Washington, D.C.?
Yes, that is correct. You know, right after this October 7th meeting in 1940, there was a meeting in the White House where the President Roosevelt met with the commander of the fleet and told him about the plan, and the admiral wouldn't go along with it, and Roosevelt fired him.
That was Admiral Richardson?
Admiral James Richardson,
right.
That's right. But Japanese reaction to this plan was almost immediate. In early November, the Japanese Navy started planning for the Pearl Harbor attack, and then these plans were leaked to Ambassador Gru, as you said, in January 1941, and he sent the message to Washington, D.C., where, strangely, the man who evaluated that was this Commander McCollum, whose idea was to have the attack, but he said, oh, there's nothing to it. And he sent that evaluation to Admiral Kimmel in Pearl Harbor. And of course, that was not true, because this is what McCollum wanted, was to Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor.
But of course, they could never allow the American people, at least at that time, to know what it was all about. Now they justify it for the greater good. But they've had one of the greatest cover-ups of all time going on literally for 50 years.
Yes, that is right. It's a total, really a total blackout for close to 59 years.
And of course, it did take us into the war. Of course, they realized that the battleships were not going to be that important. And I know that they'd moved all of the aircraft carriers out of Pearl Harbor immediately prior to the attack that sent them off to Midway, which made it almost impossible for the naval commanders then in Pearl Harbor to put the battleships to sea, because they wouldn't have any air cover. In other words, they made it literally impossible to protect those boys.
Well, that is right. Admiral Kimmel had the Pacific Fleet in the North Pacific, in the exact location where Japan was going to launch the attack on Sunday, November 23rd. And then he was told by Washington, get them out of there, take them, send the fleet back to Pearl Harbor, which he did, and the battleships were anchored there. But then he was told by Washington to move all the carriers and their support group, their cruisers and destroyers, which were the most modern ships of our Navy. And they were moved out of Pearl Harbor, so they were not there during the attack.
Do you think the Japanese had any idea that they were being set up with this?
It doesn't appear to be. There's no indication whatsoever that they thought that this was a trick to get them into the war.
And of course, the trouble was that the battleships are not a major factor in modern naval warfare. In fact, you know, you just don't use battleships. You use lighter ships, you use aircraft carriers, and that's how you carry the battle to the enemy. In fact, we don't have that many battleships now because they're really not economically feasible. So we didn't care if four or five of them were sunk. But of course, nobody was seemed to be really concerned about the loss of human life. Well, you know, as you go back, and there was really so many efforts to block you, and as you tried to get evidence of the radio transmission, didn't you run into a lot of people who, even after all of these years, were covering it up?
Well, yes. When I first started filing these Freedom of Information requests, they said that I could not see them. But in early 1990, it started to change, and some information trickled out. And by 1993, I learned that all these records that were in the vaults were going to be transferred to the National Archives. And that's why I had Freedom of Information requests. I put legal liens on these documents so that I could see them.
How do you go about doing that? How can you put a legal lien on a government document?
Well, you file a Freedom of Information Act request with that, the particular agency. And that's backed up by a federal law, which is called the Freedom of Information Act. So as an individual, you file it, first of all, you have to file it with the Navy, which I did. And they did, the Navy did eventually released the information to me. But you see, this came after most of the officers who were involved in all this cover-up had died. The last of them died in the early 1990s. So once they were no longer liable, you might say, then the Navy started releasing this information.
John Tolan told the story in his book that I believe it was General Marshall had gotten a number of these naval officers together and said in private, gentlemen, this secret will have to go to the grave with us. Did you ever find any justification for that other than his remarks?
Well, I found something even worse. On November the 15th, General George Marshall, who was the Army Chief of Staff, called the American news media who had offices in Washington. These were the bureau chiefs of Washington of the major news media like the Associated Press, New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and he called them to his office, pledged them to secrecy, and told them that we had broken the Japanese codes and that we had learned that Japan was going to attack us the first week of December. Well, General Marshall learned about that from an intercept of November 5th, 1941, in which the chief of the Japanese Navy said in a message to all the Navy, we're going to attack the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands the first week of December. So General Marshall was quoting that to the news media. But he should have told that not to the news media, but to Admiral Kimmel and General Short there in Hawaii. He didn't.
No, of course not. They were sort of set up. And, you know, as you read this whole story, you realize how treacherous they were because they left these men there. And, of course, I'm sure they felt very responsible for the death of so many of their soldiers and sailors. And I know if you've ever read, I'm sure you've read that Admiral Kimmel's story, and he was getting all this hate mail from people telling him he ought to commit suicide. He was responsible for the deaths of all those boys. And, of course, how was he to say that it was our president who was responsible? Now, apparently, Admiral Richardson, who had commanded the Pacific Fleet, didn't want to leave the fleet at Pearl Harbor because he realized that this would certainly be a magnet for a Japanese attack. And, of course, they were entirely vulnerable there. He wanted to pull our fleet back to the west coast of California, which would be much more difficult for the Japanese to attack. And what was the story there?
Yes, that is right. Admiral Richardson opposed keeping the fleet and his men there in Pearl Harbor because he didn't want them to be pawns to a Japanese attack. He sensed exactly what the president wanted. So the president called him to the Oval Office on October the 8th, 1940. This is the day after this eight action memo came forth. And the two of them had a confrontation. I would call it a knockdown, drag-out fight there in the Oval Office, because Admiral Richardson said, "Mr. President, the naval officers that I know have no confidence in you." Well, that's something you just don't tell a president of the United States, your commander-in-chief.
Not unless you want to get relieved of your command, because you don't want to betray your men.
That's right. If you don't want you don't want to betray your ships and men.
And that's exactly what MacArthur did when he sent that letter to congressman back, you know, during the Korean War. He knew he was going to lose his job, but he didn't want to be forced to betray his men.
Yes, I have not searched the Korean War.
That's just a casual comment, but yeah. I have no question at all that General MacArthur really realized that he didn't want to fight a war he wasn't going to be allowed to win. But that's neither here nor there. As far as what happened, then, of course, they appointed Admiral Kimmel to take over command of the Pacific Fleet.
Right.
Do you think he had any idea that he was being set up as a patsy?
I don't think so. Though, within a month or so, he started complaining that he was not getting information that he, on the Japanese intentions that he thought that he should. And so he made a complaint to the Chief of Naval Operations, who was Admiral Harold Stark there in Washington. Admiral Stark replied to Kimmel and said, "Don't worry, we're going to send you all the information that's possible." But they didn't.
Actually, didn't even his own intelligence officers withhold information from him?
Yes. His intelligence officer was named Lieutenant Commander Edwin Layton, and he withheld information from Admiral Kimmel.
And so poor Admiral Kimmel was just being set up. He had no idea what was going to come down the line. And, of course, he was going to be held responsible. Now, of course, you of course, go a great deal into the Japanese plans for the attack as well in the book, and you cover that really quite fascinating. They were simply monitoring the position of our ships in Pearl Harbor all this time to make sure that there'd be ships there to attack?
Yes, the Japanese Navy sent a naval ensign, under cover as a diplomat to the Japanese consulate in Honolulu, and he was a naval spy.
And, of course, we were monitoring all of his diplomatic conversations back or communications back to Japan, because we had something, we'd broken the purple code. We actually had machines that would decipher all of their communications, didn't we?
Yes, well, the purple code was the Japanese diplomatic code. It was
right.
Their main code, but it was not in Honolulu. They used a different code. That was a machine cipher, but the spy there used another code system of the Japanese Foreign Ministry.
But of course, we knew that he was telling the Japanese
That's
exactly
right.
where our ships were.
That's right.
And of course, they wanted a lot of ships there, thinking that if they could sink a lot of ships, they would defeat America, not realizing that the important ships had all been moved away.
Yes, that is correct.
And those were, of course, the aircraft carriers, the cruisers, the destroyers, the major part of the fleet. They just left those battleships there because they looked like a great target, but in reality, we were quite willing to sacrifice them. We're going to have to take a 3-minute break, and so why don't you get a cup of coffee or drink of water? And when we get back, we'll invite calls here at 464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY.